This month's episode of Shocked and Applaud contains some content not suitable for all audiences or workspaces. Listen at your own discretion.
Beef and meatloaf.
Yeah, I was gonna talk.
About
that. Oh, yeah. You got it. Yeah,
mind meld.
Yeah.
I mean, Tim Curry's meat too.
And beefy. Yeah. Well, he's lean beef.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know drug real from real real.
Welcome, Applauders, to this month's podcast. I'm Jen McQuaid.
I'm Lydia Malcolm.
And I'm Naomi McQuaid. And you know what movie we're doing because you clicked on the thing.
Why haven't we done this movie yet?
Because we didn't have Sean select it for his choice yet.
We're doing it now. That's all that matters.
It truly is.
Doing it now, doing it live.
We're going to
live in the fact that we were here living during the time that we recorded it.
Podcasting. I want to do recording.
Check the mic and the headphones. Make sure they're not dead phones.
edit me because I'm messing up recording. Shorten, speed up, and delete me. Editing ladies tonight.
Editors of the night.
Editors of the night.
Editors of the night.
Editors of the night. Cha cha cha.
So dumb. So sorry.
All right. So
you'll never guess what movie we're doing.
Well, they do because they clicked on the thing.
That's true.
So, all right. So, Rocky Horror Picture Show, Naomi. How did you come to this movie?
It's pretty weird. So back in the day, okay, go back with me to like
1975.
I didn't exist, and neither did you. Okay, so come back with me to the year of our Lord, like 1988. I am something like 5 or 6. It might be 89. Uh-huh. It was certainly before like 93, right? Because that's like when my real memories came. Like, this is just after I've achieved consciousness. And I'm laying in bed on the top bunk. My sister got the bottom bunk.
Right, because she was older.
Yeah. And I was like, talk to me. And I, you know, desire to be entertained. And so she was not one to entertain me back in the day. And so she told me a tale of murder and cannibalism and like just terror and a mad doctor. And I was an anxious child. And when I would get scared, I'd puke. This one I managed to not puke about, but I remember like being awake and staring hard and not sleeping because of this horror story that I was told. And then without having ever seen it, we got the movie book. So it had parts of the script. It had these glossy pictures. It was beautiful black book with like the lips across the front of it. And I read it, like all of it, as like a 10-year-old. And it was years before I had actually saw the movie. I was probably a teenager. And then I was like, oh, that horror story Maggie told me was the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And that was the book I read that entire summer. And then I watched the video, I think probably before I went and saw it in the theater, definitely. And then I saw it probably a half a dozen times. And I've watched it, you know, every few years ever since. And it's a cult classic that has been in my heart since, as close to day one as you can get.
Nice.
Yeah. I've dragged many a people to a show.
Including me.
And I've sacrificed several virgins. And I got sacrificed twice, so I've put in my time.
What about you, Lydia?
Drama was the reason why I found this, probably because of Naomi bringing it to like an after party for one of our stage plays. Like, I remember doing the time warp in someone's basement. And I don't think that was like the, I don't think that was the first time I saw it, because I remember doing the dance and just really liking it and everything. So it may have been like the second or third time I saw it. But yeah, I don't like.
I was weirdly sexually charged after play.
Yeah, parties. Yeah, I don't even remember whose house it was. I think it may have been like, I want to say it was after Twelfth Night, but because I don't think it was after Godspell, and I definitely don't think it was after Spoon River Anthology.
No, however, Marcus was doing his monologue from it, and he goes, I was the skier of the, what, he was a skier who died. Yeah. And I was like, you sound exactly like Riff Raff when you deliver that line. And then he couldn't get it out of his head, so it sounded more and more like Riff Raff. And he never performed in drama ever again. It's all my fault.
But like, that only made Spoon River Anthology better. For those of you who don't know, Spoon River Anthology is a collection of monologues about this like town and the folks in
the town.
It's
all the dead people. It takes place in a cemetery. And who gives that to high school students? We called it affectionately Spoon River.
Because that was essentially how it felt.
It really did. I got one laugh while on stage, and Hendrickson thought I was comedic relief for the rest of my high school career.
You got typecasted.
I did. She's not that attractive or leading lady, but she can get a laugh. Mm-hmm. And I lean into that. Yeah. I lean into that hard.
What about you, Jen?
Okay. So I believe it was Comedy Central that would play this movie. It might have been the Sci-Fi Channel that played this movie really, really late at night with not a lot of edits. Not a ton of edits.
What about the nipples, though?
Because some of that happens during like prominent things. It would be hard to kind of.
Yeah, but I remember them blurring stuff back in the day more often.
I remember being at my dad's house for visitation, and I was the only one still awake, and I was watching TV.
You have an anxiety disorder too?
It's almost like we have a lot in common.
So I was Skinamax, though.
And I did not start at the beginning of this movie. And I think that if it had started if I had watched it from the beginning, I probably would have turned it off, because the beginning is a little boring, at least from a kid's perspective. But no, it was during the reveal of Frankenfurter, like coming down from the elevator. And that's where I like started the movie.
That is an excellent place to begin.
Mm-hmm. And there was a definite like awakening moment. Mm-hmm. Like I think a lot of us had.
It's one of the first overtly sexual things I ever watched. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was like, oh.
And I remember thinking to myself something like, that woman isn't barely wearing any clothes at all. I had no idea who Tim Curry was, even though, like, you know, there was Toxic Love, Ferngully.
Oh, I have that downloaded currently.
that was my Tim Curry sexual awakening, was Toxic Love from Ferngully.
Oh, when he goes, that's rather nice.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Mr. Curry. Mm-hmm.
And he was on, like, Fox's Peter Pan and the Pirates.
Oh, yeah. That was, like, a cartoon show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was my initial like, and then I never saw it or heard of it again until Drama. And I was introduced to Decatur Drama a year earlier than you, Naomi, and I believe Chandra took me to a midnight showing.
Was it like a 16-year-old?
Yeah, 16, maybe 17.
Mm-mm.
No.
I met you the second time in September for auditions for Twelfth Night. And it was early September, so you hadn't turned 17 yet. Because I remember what I gave you for your 18th birthday.
I did not have to go up as a virgin. Like I it was explained to other people that she's 16 years old, and
maybe it's not the best thing to do to a 16-year-old.
Oh, applauders. If you for some reason do not know, viewing this movie at a midnight showing is all about calling out and acting out the scenes. And having performers reenact the movie underneath the screen. And preceding all of that, they do a sacrifice of virgins. You have a V on your forehead and lipstick. And then you had to come up and perform some sort of, like, not sexually charged in that it was like a, you know, it was not a sexual environment for me, or I think for most people, but it was like you had to, quote unquote, lose your virginity by, like, pretending to orgasm or eating a Twinkie really fast in front of people, or like half a dozen other things I think I've seen over the years. But it's funny. It's generally funny. It's all consensual. Like, you choose to do it. I only got, like, I was like, the second time I was like, oh, no, I've been before. And he's like, in the last 3 months. And I was like, no. And he's like, well, you gotta go again. Apparently it does grow back.
Yeah. So I wasn't under the impression that it was consensual, because I've been to only one midnight showing of Rocky Horror. And there was someone, who was it? There was Chris.
Okay.
But we both looked at each other and can't remember if he asked me to, or he just, we both kind of looked at each other and we both knew that we were going to lie, saying that we had been before. And so it was like, no, like, I don't think I'd ever go if that's a rule, because I'm just not really into public displays of degradation.
Oh yeah. And I do think it, of course, depends on every showing is a different community. So, like,
right. You know. And maybe it's changed. So that way, if someone says, no, I don't really want to do this, then they're like, okay, well, you don't have to. Maybe it's like, if you want to do it, it's something that you can do. It's like when you go to the altar calls for churches, like, if you don't want to go, you don't have to.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I think we as a culture are getting more in line with what consent truly is.
Right.
And so this movie is not a testament to that, but I think the community around it could be.
Yeah. And I think, like, if there was a midnight showing where that was consensual, I would totally go again, because I like yelling out things at theaters and, you know, yes. Throw toast at a screen. Yes, please.
The sing-along. I went to a sing-along for Sound of Music, and it was pretty stinking good.
This definitely was a prominent part of my later adolescence in introducing me to queer culture. Yeah.
I don't think I realized how much this movie influenced me until I was watching it and taking notes for once. You know, I was like, oh, like several times.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's been probably, it's been more than 20 years since this really was kind of an instrumental or big part of our just growing up together.
Mm-hmm.
And we still were able to, like, remember some of the audience quotes,
mm-hmm.
and things that the audience participation part.
We're trying not to lean heavily on that, applauders, because, you know, it's a live experience. You should go do it if you choose to. But, like, it doesn't make good podcasting, I don't think. We might mention some that are really good, but they're not universal. They change per presentation. So, you know, take that for what you will. We're going for the movie.
Yeah, I think today was probably the first time that I really took notice and tried to understand the plot and the interaction.
Yes.
And just the overall development of the character.
How could I have watched this a dozen or more times and still be like, I never noticed that before? That's good filmmaking, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or bad attendance by me. I don't know which.
All right. It's Price is Right.
Oh. Okay.
Price is Right rules? I thought we don't do the Price is Right rules.
Closest without going over.
Yeah. I do. I have to absolve myself from knowing how much the movie made, because I did see that. I was checking out, like, other movies, and apparently this was, like, second of the year. Sorry. I just also spoiled that, but I didn't give a number.
No, that's fine.
So
that's fine.
All right.
Let's go ahead and just say what that is, since Sean has that. And then we can...
Yeah. The cost for production or the gross?
Budget.
Because I don't know the budget, but I know how much it made. So
Okay, so I think the budget had to have been no less... And it's... Oh, wait, what year? 78?
75.
Okay. I think it could be no less than... let's say $3 million. Don't make that noise. I say it was $1.5 million.
$100 billion.
After we watched this film, I started watching Austin Powers. That's why as like kind of a cool down. Jen caught me. She's like, we're leaving in like 10 minutes. You just start another movie. And I'm like, yeah, baby. Yeah. So yeah, I'll 1 million and 0.5.
Okay.
I'm going to say 5 million.
All right. Well, none of us won by Price is Right rules, but the budget was 1.4 million.
Oh! Excuse me, Jen. Shocked and Applaud rules is pretty damn close. Is pretty damn close.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good.
I don't think we
Damn is not a swear. The times, they are changing.
Is a swear. I'm gonna edit all of it out.
Except for this one.
Well, I'm glad that that is how, knowing how much it made, I am so glad that the budget was that low.
It kind of, if is it a number that would make it out of the B movie range? Like a B movie, I don't know if there's actually criteria for this, but it would be like double budget or less. Not widely released.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know about the release, but do you want to guess how much it made?
So here's the thing. Sean's number is inclusive of every time this has been released in the theaters.
Oh.
Or played in the theaters.
Then that's probably going to be a bigger number than what I saw on Wikipedia.
It's possible.
Yeah. Okay. Every re-release and its initial release. And we're doing gross or net?
It's always gross.
Yeah. I would say that this movie has made $30 million.
I already know, so. Go ahead, Jen.
Are you sure? You don't want to...
The amount on Wikipedia says 50.4 million.
Well, it is 246 million and counting.
Nice.
Because people still do midnight screenings and that sort of deal.
Applauders, if you hear clicking and clacking in the background, that's because we're recording in the place that we always record, which is down in the basement. But Naomi and Jen got their own place, which means I get to move down to the basement. And that means Wonder Boy is out on the linoleum. And those are his claws clicking and clacking.
I find it kind of a soothing noise.
Mm-hmm. He's so cute when he's walking around. I get vacation vibes from him right now. He's just like, I'm cruising where I look.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, I don't know about you, since we've gone through the budget and box office, but it seems to me like now would be a good time to maybe go for Sean Facts.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's not how I like to hear it.
Sean Facts.
Sean Facts.
That's the business.
So, I do not have a piece of paper with me today for Sean Facts, so it might be a little bit more scattered than it typically is, because I can't go through the paper and cross out things that I know that I've talked about. But there is so much that Sean has put into the facts today, so I may not even be able to get through everything. There's just a ton. And in fact, when he... at the top of his notes, it says, let's do this.
Okay, Sean. Okay.
In 2005, it was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Based on the Rocky Horror Show, without the picture in the title, a musical with music, lyric, and book by Richard O'Brien, who plays Riff Raff, which has a humorous tribute to the science fiction and horror B-movies of the 30s through the early 60s, the show was produced and directed by Jim Sharman. The original London production of the musical was premiered at the Royal Court Theatre upstairs on 19th of June, 1973, after two previews on the 16th and 18th. It later moved to several other locations in London and closed on 13th of September, 1980. The show ran for a total of 2,960 performances and won the 1973 Evening Standard Theatre Award for Best Musical. In 1974, it debuted in the U.S. in Los Angeles and had a, this is the play version, and had a successful nine-month run, but its 1975 Broadway debut at the Belasco Theatre lasted only three previews and 45 showings, despite earning one Tony nomination and three Drama Desk nominations. Initial reception was extremely negative.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds about right for 1970s.
Oh, for the play? Are we talking about the movie now?
This would have been the film's reception.
Okay.
But it soon became a hit as a midnight movie when audiences began participating with the film at the Waverly Theater in New York City in 1976. Audience members returned to the cinemas frequently and talked back to the screen and began dressing as the characters, spawning similar performance groups across the United States. At almost the same time, fans in costume at the King's Court Theater in Pittsburgh began performing alongside the film, and this shadow cast mimed the actions on screen above and behind them while lip-syncing their characters' lines. We have some production notes here. Most of the cast were from the original London stage production, including Tim Curry. So he was in the stage production.
He's OG even?
Mm-hmm.
You can tell.
And he had decided that Dr. Frankenfurter should speak like the Queen of the United Kingdom, extravagantly posh. Fox Studio executives insisted on casting the two characters of Brad and Janet with American actors Barry Bostwick and Susan Sarandon. During filming, Sarandon fell ill with pneumonia. I bet it was during the rain stuff,
yeah.
Right? writer and actor Richard O'Brien loved science fiction and B-horror movies, and they wanted to combine elements of the unintentional humor of B-horror movies, portentous dialogue of schlock horror, Steve Reeves' musical flicks, and 50s rock and roll and into his musical. O'Brien conceived and wrote the play set against the backdrop of the glam era that had manifested itself in British popular culture in the 1970s. Some of the costumes from the film had been originally used in the stage production, and props and set pieces were reused from old Hammer horror production and others. The tank and dummy used for Rocky's birth originally appeared in The Revenge of Frankenstein in 1958.
Hell yeah!
All right, I'm going to skim now. It seems like I've been reading for quite a while.
I'd just like to take a second to say, reduce, reuse, recycle.
Mm-hmm.
For what?
He reused all the props.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
All right. How about two more? The original script called for the beginning of the film to be shot in black and white and to then transition to color as Brad and Janet enter the world of the Transylvanians a la The Wizard of Oz.
That sounds like it would have been awesome.
There are a lot of parallels between this movie and Wizard of Oz.
There's a lot of parallels between this movie and every other movie in existence.
True. Even Jurassic Park. Especially Jurassic Park.
Yeah. And the unbelievable Mr. Ripley.
Mm-hmm. And
King with Matt Damon.
Steve Martin auditioned to play Brad, but was passed over for Barry Bostwick, who had received a Tony nomination in 1972 for creating the role of Danny Zuko in Grease.
I could not, would not, Steve Martin. Could not, would not.
I mean, he did really well as the dentist in, Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah,
but
he's got acting chops, but he's no Brad.
He's not a Brad.
He's not even a bruh.
Could you see Steve Martin in fishnets doing the leg that Barry Boswick does?
Oh, he would ham it too much.
Mm-hmm.
He has the same. Okay, so sometimes, not all the time, like things like Murder in the Apartment. No, only Murders in the Apartment. Like he's really. He really delivers on that. But in the same way that I have a problem with Kristen Wiig, is that there's this kind of like energy towards the camera that is like, I know how funny I'm being right now. And it works for them in certain types of roles, but it would not work in this one, which is defined by a sincerity that he lacks in this kind of film. And and that's fine. There's plenty of work for Steve Martin.
Yeah. Barry Boswick does it so sincere.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no, I don't know what the word is, but I think Steve Martin would not treat it with a kind of, like we did Little Shop of Horrors, the plotters. You can go back to our Little Shop of Horrors and listen to us rant about how Steve Martin totally hams up the villain in that. And
wonderfully.
Mm-hmm, wonderfully. Does a great job.
Yeah.
But he is not a Brad.
No.
Yeah. And I think it works best to have sort of a
literal straight man.
Yeah. But the, to have very straight acting from these two outside perspectives.
It's characters. what makes the other character so fantastical.
Yeah. Like Dorothy discovering Oz.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between, I mean, like part of it is her discovery, Like you're seeing this world through her eyes.
Oh, yeah. We, the audience, are Brad and Janet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. I have one more for us before we can jump into the plot. And it is something that relates to what Lydia was mentioning when we watched the movie. Fox released the film around college campuses on a double bill with another rock music film parody. Can anyone guess what that rock film parody would have been?
I have no idea. 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Rock music. Tommy?
I know which one you're talking about, but I want to see Naomi squirm a little bit more.
Not Phantom of the Opera. That was earlier by a couple of years. Rock opera? Pink Floyd's The Wall.
I did not mention Pink Floyd's The Wall during our rewatch. And it wasn't Phantom of the Opera because that wouldn't have come out a while back. It was Phantom of the Paradise.
That's what I meant to say, Phantom of the
Paradise. 1974 is Phantom of the Paradise.
Are you shitting me?
No. I am not shitting you.
Weep.
Could you imagine if you had to make weep noise every time?
I mean, I could just do it one time and then we can just copy and paste.
What's the point of having the weep button?
It would be my bleep. Bleep.
Oh, I like the techie sound because it sounds like our intro.
Yeah.
Which Jen wrote in like one sitting, like 5-6 years ago.
The song.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's a really good one.
Thank you.
I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts now at work, and every time they have a shitty intro, I'm like, meh, meh. Yeah. I have a really good one.
Yeah. Because she said shitty. So, so got to do that twice.
You just shove that towards me and I will do it.
Get you a stick.
Fine. But you gotta be on top of the swears. Golly darn Darcy counts.
It does when Jen's the producer.
I don't think I could imagine hearing just like a Faustian operatic. What does he say? What's her name?
Phoenix.
Phoenix. I'm just 7 hours old. Like, I just couldn't. No.
Yeah.
Couldn't do it.
There is a huge tone difference between the two of them. Though Phantom of the Paradise does end with Beef. And he's pretty in line with Rocky Horror.
Beef could fit in Rocky Horror Picture. That's probably why he was my favorite character, my favorite Disney princess in that film.
Yeah.
Beef and Meatloaf.
Yeah. I was gonna talk
about
that. Oh, no, you know it. You got it. Yeah.
Mind meld.
Yeah.
I mean, Tim Curry's meat too.
And beefy. Well, he's lean beef.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know drug reel from real reel.
I know Meatloaf from Beef.
We ready for some plot?
We're going to go into the plot.
Oh, yeah. We're just going to plot this down.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
There's an immediate Sean fact for this.
Of course there is.
Okay, so the lips.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Everybody knows that, though, right? I mean,
I think even if you don't have never seen it, you've probably seen the lips on like a poster or.
Oh, it's a tattoo I want. I just don't know where I'd put it or how big I'd put it.
My first note is counterculture icon. This entire movie is just nothing but pure counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a Fox screen, right? And then a music swell.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then from Blackness, my first note after the title on my notes is those lips. These beautiful red full lips show up. And I wanted them. And you know, we've talked about it a lot, and like especially in where I started in our The Cell episode, which is really good if you guys ever want to go back and listen to it. But a lot
of people have that. Cell Part 1, for some reason, is our most popular episode.
I like a bold lip.
Mm-hmm.
And J-Lo be having that. And so does the lips, interestingly enough, in this production. A Sean fact?
Oh, yes. Disembodied female lips appear overdubbed with a male voice.
I thought, okay, maybe it's an urban legend. I always thought it was Tim Curry's lips.
It is not. I'll finish the paragraph here and it'll all be revealed.
Okay, sorry.
establishing the theme of androgyny to be repeated as the film unfolds. The opening scene and song science fiction double feature consists of the lips of Patricia Quinn, who appears in the film later as the character Magenta and as Trixie the Usherette in the original London production, where she also sings the song, but has the vocals of actor and Rocky Horror creator Richard O'Brien, who appears as Magenta's brother Riff Raff.
And it's funny because Riff Raff has always wanted to be inside Magenta.
You're talking about the character?
Yes.
Yeah. That's
so gross.
It's accurate, though, so be about it.
The lyrics refer to science fiction and horror films of the past and list several film titles from the 1930s and 60s. You want to see if you can identify a couple of them?
They had mentioned Flash Gordon. They had mentioned King Kong and Fay Wray. And then that actually gets referenced later on in the film.
Did you say Lost in Space already?
That was towards the end of the film. Are you saying that that was a
is this not a reference in there?
It actually is not.
Oh, what I know about naming films.
You don't have to be good at names. It's okay.
I'm bad at names, and that's funny. Mm-hmm. If you want to hear me be real bad at names, please listen to our Earth Girls Are Easy episode.
That was great.
So there's a movie referenced in this song that is also referenced in our Army of Darkness movie, that movie review.
A movie that we referenced in Army of Darkness? I don't know. We talk about a lot of movies while we talk about movies.
No, it's in Army of Darkness.
Oh, it's the poster. It's the poster in the trunk?
I don't know.
Klaatu, Verata.
Oh, The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Ah.
Yeah. It's my mother-in-law's favorite.
Also, The Invisible Man, It Came from Outer Space, Dr. X, Forbidden Planet, I think you mentioned, Tarantula is one of them, The Day of the Triffids in 1962, Curse of the Demon, and When Worlds Collide. So that's Sean's facts on the lips.
I like that. I didn't know that. I think that's very cool. Mm-hmm. I do like the androgyny focus and like the queerness of the entire film, which I'm sure we're going to reference again and again. But the fact that we're starting there.
Right. It's nice that that was put into the film along with everything else that is like, you know, maybe gender or gender expression is a social construct. And it's not something that can really be, you know, dictated by the Brads and the Janets of the world.
Richard O'Brien himself actually identifies as non-binary.
Which is hard because if your name is Dick and you're non-binary, it must be very hard. if you're like sexually promiscuous, but your name is Virginia.
Do I have to bleep somebody's name?
No, because we're not referencing the body part or it's an actual person's name. It's like
they don't go by that, so it's fine.
If we were talking about Dick Grayson, you wouldn't be bleeping Dick because it's Dick Grayson.
Yeah, but if you're like Penis McFace,
then that would be
a person's name and you wouldn't have to bleep it.
No, I'm pretty sure we would have to bleep it. Censorship 101 via Shocked and Applaud. Thank you so much for listening. Yay! Oh, no, never mind.
The font that they use. They pause the lips. They start doing, you know, starring as, but the font is like bloody drips. Mm-hmm. And it is perfect. And I would write every work email in it if that was possible.
Yeah, it works really well. And it sets up the fact that, like, you know that it's a horror show.
But, I mean, it's the title.
Yeah, but I mean, like the fact that it's also there in like they're committing to it. So and it kind of puts a lot of like there's aspects of this movie that are so over the top that when you do have those moments of like a sincere performance, like we were talking about Barry Boswick's sincere performance, it's one of those things where like it just meshes so well.
You have to have that contrast, and they play with it very well.
It's like how broccoli goes so well with mac and cheese.
Did you say broccoli?
Broccoli with mac and cheese.
Then you're just eating a healthy dish.
And you're saying that Rocky Horror Picture Show isn't a healthy meal?
No, I'm saying it is.
Yeah.
When you eat the two together.
Yeah. And then it suddenly becomes healthy because, yeah.
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 Just like if you eat a piece of cake, you can drink a Diet Coke and you're fine.
Mm-hmm. Or if it's carrot cake, then it's automatically healthy.
It's basically a salad.
Yeah. A sugary salad.
But like, you know how, like, I don't wear a lot of lipstick anymore, but oh, every human being has a red lip that they can wear. Mm-hmm. You just have to find yours And those lips are so red.
Kudos to the makeup department for making it so that there isn't any lipstick on the teeth. Mm-hmm. That would have been super distracting.
I want to know how they blocked it out so that there's like no like skin. It's just lips and teeth and tongue.
Oh, I could imagine they like probably put some black paint over. Like black face paint right over the lips. And then they put They don't do like the entire face. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They just put like right over the lips, and then they put like black stuff. Or maybe it's like, oh, have you ever heard of the music group Passion Pit? They do a song called "I'll Be All Right," and it's like this guy in like this art museum, and he sees this piece of art that has lips, and it's like singing the song, and then he goes in for a kiss, and he just like starts making out with this piece of art, and it's just lips with like this like stretched fabric over them. So it probably was something like that.
Okay, I'll take it.
Yeah. And also applauders, the important thing is this is the first song of the movie, which is, as Jen mentioned, science fiction double feature.
Dr. X will build a creature. Okay. We will try not to sing every song all the way through, but right. That's the one that sounds like that.
Yeah. And then we get into our first scene, which is a wedding.
Yeah, the song ends and it goes dun 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 dun, which we hear twice in the movie. This is the first time.
Mm-hmm. And you see a group of people coming out of a chapel. You also see Richard O'Brien, Tim Curry, and the two ladies who
Columbia and Magenta.
Columbia and Magenta. You see them later on. And they're like, Tim Curry's playing the preacher. And then you have like his attendants played by Riff Raff, Magenta, and Columbia.
Yeah. Tim Curry's only for this part where they're getting like the picture done. He mm-hmm. turns around for a minute. And then when we adjust the scene, he's gone and the three remain. Mm-hmm. This is the scene for Easter eggs. You know, Brad's friend from high school and college is all like, we did it. And he's like, yeah, you sure did. And he's all like, to believe it all started in Dr. Scott's refresher class. And his friend is like, yeah, but that's the only reason I went because Betty Monroe was in there or whatever. So then they get in their car. The married couple gets in the car.
The car says, wait till tonight. She got hers. Now he'll get his.
Which we hate.
Oh, it's so gross.
We hate it, don't we, ladies?
Yeah. I mean, I find it just offensive for so many reasons.
Like, yeah.
But it's intentional.
Women get possessed.
Women get their wedding. They get the pretty dress and the pretty ring. And guys get the sex. That's why I don't like it.
Yeah. I don't like that whole like a woman is only worth anything if she's like virginal and pure, whatever the that means.
Or she's only worth something when she's possessed by a man.
Yes. A woman is property.
Yeah.
And that property needs to be like a white slate. Like, have you ever, now I don't watch the Kardashians, but have you seen inside a Kardashian's house, like on blurbs or whatever of a TV?
Yeah, it's pretty bland.
It's all white and it's got little points of color or decoration or whatever, but it's this sterile thing. And I don't know if you've been a human lately, but there's very little that is that maintainably untouched.
Mm-hmm.
And admittedly I have been touched.
Do they have pets? Because
the Kardashians?
Yeah. Well, okay.
But if one of the things about being rich is having opulence and the ability to maintain that opulence to that degree.
Because all I think about when you were talking about how it's pure white, I was just thinking, you know, Cricket's gonna make it all messy. A puppy's gonna make that stuff messy.
But then they'll just get a new couch.
Yeah.
And then they'll just like they'll hire another, probably, I don't know, I don't want to blame them for like hiring you know, undocumented, underpaid persons, but other rich people certainly do that. So whatever, exploiting, and it's useless. Like if I had money, I'd want to do something useful with it.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like a huge house and lots of white stuff is useful to anyone other than showing off.
It sounds so bland.
Like you can't wear your shoes. And now Americans wear shoes inside all the time. It's stupid. But like, I want to be able to I want to be able to drink something or like eat. Set my toast on the edge of the couch because I forgot to grab a napkin and not freak out about it, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm gross, honey.
And that leads us back to the movie, because we're setting up the convention. We're setting up the norm that we ultimately have to break. And part of setting that up is saying that there are these very specific roles. Like when the bouquet gets tossed, Janet catches it. And Brad just says, I really like how you fought for that bouquet over those other women.
Yeah. So the wedding party departs and the guests run after the car, and then they're alone. And now... There is, you know, is it called Damn It, Janet?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Brad starts singing to Janet, presents her with a ring. It's beautifully tacky.
Yeah.
You know, I worked for a short time I worked for 3 years with a lady named Janet, and she was always being like, damn it, Janet, to herself or whatever. It was just so funny. She liked the reference, and I don't think people get to have that as much as they should. A musical reference that you don't hate about yourself.
Mm-hmm. I've an aunt named Janet.
Oh, yeah, that's true. She's very nice.
You had mentioned that they were setting up for a funeral.
Yes. So what happens is, he has a piece of chalk in his pocket for some reason and draws a heart on that. And one of my favorite call outs is he goes, damn it, Janet, I love you. But the crowd would scream, only assholes right on doors, which is so good. Because like the guy, the riffraff and magenta immediately turn around and start wiping it off. Because why would you draw on a church?
Yeah.
And then without being like a political thing, you're just drawing hearts on things. Okay, whatever. I'm all for protesting. So if that's what it is, that's fine. But if you're just being a jerk, then I'm not down. But they burst into the church, and the three are like, they magically appear places. So the two burst into the church, and they're already in there like polishing the pews, and they're dusting these flower arrangements. And as Brad and Janet like take each other's arms and start walking down the aisle, the ladies turn the plants, and they go from being like these white and pink and blue plants to being completely black, because it's half one way and half the other. And I'm like, that's just good use of space.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you realize is they are now setting up for a funeral immediately following a wedding. And that is church people life.
Yeah.
You just end up doing stuff like that, because like that's the only day that you can have services for whatever. So it's the wedding in the morning and the funeral at night. So, but it also is like there is a finality and an ending of life when you get married. in culturally speaking, like I don't personally feel this way, but like, I mean, by the time you have kids, you have completed all of your goals and you're done now. And that's too little. Just think, an hour ago, she was just plain old Betty Monroe, and now she's Mrs. Ralph Hapshat. Right? If people introduced me as Mrs. Jen McQuaid, I'd be like, oh, no, 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 oh, no, 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 no. And that terribleness has never been better made fun of, not made fun of, but like encountered than on Adventure Brothers when it's Dr. Mrs. the Monarch. Don't worry, I'm using the right bathroom. I get it all the time.
Ah, transgenders.
I'm sorry, Jen. It's just she's not.
I know she isn't, but
she's voiced by a man, and it's pretty good. I don't mind when people like of different genders voice different. I think it's whatever voice works for that character.
Mm-hmm. Transgenders aren't referenced in this movie, but
the name
transvestite is, and transsexual is.
Yeah. Okay. So I might have overcorrected Sean the other day. Is the word transsexual still used?
It is not used in polite culture.
Okay. So yeah. So I only used the term transgendered, and then I just used the abbreviated trans to refer to individuals, because I think transgendered is too strong of a word to apply to an individual. I think, well, that's just my personal taste. I don't think I'm trying to use the appropriate language, but you know, transvestite is right out.
Yeah.
Sean asked me if it would be okay for us to do this movie. He asked for my permission. Aww. Which kind of felt awesome, I guess.
Well, it's nice because, like, if we're going to handle something.
There is a definite time box around this movie, even though it still has cultural significance, according to Library of Congress, mm-hmm. which it does. There's different terms, and there's a different outlook on what transgenderism is in this. And you can, thankfully, at the end of the day, hope I'm not spoiling anything for you, but we can just, you know, excuse it as aliens.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, they explain that in the last scene. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And and for that purpose, I think they only refer to Dr. Frankenfurter by he, him pronouns, if I'm remembering right, which means that he's not a, and only using the word that they use, like he calls himself a transvestite, which was a more appropriate term back then and is obviously not something we use now. But I mean, like, you can be trans and refer to yourself to whatever gender. It's fine. Mm-hmm. But it's just interesting. It is. It's certainly encapsulated. And because it's removed and because it's fantastic. I'm using not as a moral term. Fantastic in that it is bigger than life, I think.
An aesthetic term, not a moral term.
Yeah, I think because it's so fantastic, I think that really lends itself to being able to be taken as the entity that it is. Mm-hmm. So we're at the wedding, right?
We're after the wedding.
We're at the over the proposal, the funeral. They bring in a coffin.
Yeah.
And I think Janet's character really solidifies the roles. She's just like, now we're engaged, and it's better than Betty Monroe had. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that you know Mom and you know Dad, you know? And so he's fulfilled all of these roles. They're going through the nuclear setup of we met in high school, dated through college. Now we're engaged around the time our friends are getting engaged.
We're on the track that everybody expects us to be on.
A heteronormative friggin' stereotype to be had. Mm-hmm. A cis white heteronormative expectation.
Right. And then we cut to them in a car and it's raining and there's...
Because they decide in the middle of that song that they have to go visit the professor who got them together.
Oh, okay.
There's only one thing to do.
And that's to see Dr. Scott.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're heading to Dr. Scott. And so when they're in the car, it's raining and there's stuff on the radio that... So this movie takes place... Oh, is there... Am I missing something?
The criminal... expert guy.
Oh, that's
so
right.
So we're introduced to our narrator, or at least our expositionist.
He's an expert.
Yeah. Exposition, exhibitionist. Whatever. He pops in. We go to his study and he's just like, oh yes. Brad and Janet, like Brad Majors and Janet Weiss. He pulls out a criminal file and you're like, what? Because it's just been this happy scene so far. But you know, because of the title, that you're going to get into some stuff. But he flips through and he's just like, oh, yes, they're on their way to see their professor, Dr. Everett Scott. And this guy has no neck. And then it does this drip wipe from the top to the bottom, which is really cool. And now we're in a rainy car driving scene. And motorcyclists go past them real fast. And she's like, oh, yeah, that has to be dangerous. And he goes, yeah, life is pretty cheap for that type.
Yeah.
Brad, you dickbag.
The radio is going off about the president and Congress, and this movie takes place like a year after the Watergate scandal. So I think that I didn't check to see if this was like around the time of Nixon's resignation.
This is his resignation speech.
I thought it was because they was like, now I'm resigning, and I'm like, oh, is that Nixon? Is that Nixon? So it makes sense. But it kind of like gives you an idea of what Brad and Janet are focused on. They're mm-hmm. focused on specific politics. They're focused on the politic heavy radio. They're not interested in music.
She's reading a newspaper and eating a candy bar. And he's like focused on driving. I don't know if they seem particularly in tuned with whatever's going on, but it just seems like the right thing to do, like the procedurally right thing to do.
Mm hmm. Procedurally right thing is very accurate for a lot of their where they're at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, like this is the next thing. Whoa.
It also places the movie like mm-hmm. in time. This is not like something that happened like 20 years ago. It's something that happened today. This year.
Mm-hmm.
The movie came out in 75 and the speech was in 74. Mm-hmm. So it's
very
it's
of the time.
Day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they hit a dead end and Brad's like, oh, I must have made a wrong turn. And he's like, well, I guess we'll just have to turn around. Turns around. Doesn't turn around. He starts to back up and immediately blows a tire. And then she's like, oh, what was that? And he goes, must have blown a tire. And then he like slaps the seat next to her. And he's like, oh, I know I should have gotten that I should have gotten air in that spare tire. And she rolls her eyes so hard, they might have a little popped out of her head.
I missed that altogether.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah. But Brad realizes that they passed a castle, and that castle might have a phone.
A castle in Texas. And I was about to say, who would have thunk? But then I thought about Texas.
Because they're in Denton, and Denton, Texas is where it takes place.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
they were going back home to where they began it when they met in that science exam it.
Oakley Court, Dr. Frankenfurter's castle, was used in numerous Hammer horror movies made at adjacent Bray Studios, where the lab and ballroom scenes were shot, including The House in Nightmare Park, 1973, The Reptile, 1966, The Brides of Dracula, 1960, and The Man in Black, 1950. Built in 1859, it was refurbished in 1981 and converted into a hotel. So you can go stay at this place.
10. I have a list of famous hotels I want to go to. Guess what you're going to add to the list?
This one?
Yes, please. You really should have a spreadsheet.
I really should.
I got one more Shining hotel to go to. I want to go to this hotel. Mm-hmm. Maybe the hotel that's in the American Horror Story season. But it's based on the Cecil, but the Cecil's more like a hotel building, I think. But there's like right next to it, like adjacent to it, there's a nicer hotel.
But back to the movie.
I want to do vacation talk.
We'll save that for another podcast.
Okay, because we have to talk about what I used to think of as my most hated song.
Brad's like, oh, I'll just go ahead and go back to that castle.
I'm going with you.
And he's like, no, it'll make you all wet.
But what if there's a woman in the castle who just takes you away from me?
And she's like, what if there's a more beautiful woman in the castle?
And he is.
Yeah.
That's another thing we used to call out. That's what we used to call out in the theater.
Again, foreshadowing.
Yeah, totally.
So, and so they both head out into the rain to this castle. Janet puts the newspaper over her head, and we get into the song, There's a Light.
They do pass a sign that says, enter at your own risk.
Right.
That's written in an iconic like red font.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I hated this song so much is my next. I'm like, here's the reasons why I hated it. They are so wet the entire time. Just soaking wet. Like this must be why she got pneumonia, right?
Yeah.
And whenever it came on, I'd be like, let's get on with it. And I'm totally like King Julian. I'm like, how long is this going to take?
I want to look up the lyrics.
Oh, I can sing them for you. In the velvet darkness of the darkest night, there's a light burning bright.
There's the second chorus goes, the darkness must go down the river of night streaming.
Oh, but it's riffraff singing it. So it goes, darkness may flow now the streams of light gleaming. Mm-hmm.
It's perfect.
Thank you.
Oh, no, that was the part that stuck out to me. There's a light in the darkness of everybody's life. And it's almost like
there's a darkness in everybody's life.
What was interesting is like it's kind of like. Kind of just makes me think that on a subconscious level, Brad and Janet are just not happy with being on this track because, like, I mean, they're stuck in, you know, the night and it's raining and it's difficult. And then they're like, oh, but there's hope at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the entire, like, journey, like when they come out of the light at the end of the tunnel, they're completely different people.
Yes. Opposed to a lot of movies we review, there's actual character arc here.
Yeah, but like this kind of makes me think like, are they like they're following the rules, they're doing what they have to, and they're playing up that they're happy about it. But are they?
I think that one of the very transformative things about Jen and I's marriage is that we were like trying to hit all of these marks for so long. I mean, Jen is a golden child who like does things wonderfully by the book or has done for a number of years, right? But the second that you declared who you are and stepped away from this assigned role, right? Like, I think that you became a lot happier. And I feel like the more I step away of the expectation of people for me, the more I'm able to make decisions that make me ultimately happier. Like, no, I don't have to be quiet when a man is talking, especially if I have a good point, you mm-hmm. know? I am allowing myself to be corrected by people who are different than me in a good way. Like, I'm like, oh, I can take instruction because I'm choosing not to be the rightest, whitest, most matriarchal woman in the room. Like, that is healthier for me, I think, overall.
I think one of the strengths in our relationships is that we've been challenged in our relationship. Like, we've just had dark seasons that we've had to get through.
And these young nubiles haven't at all.
Right. And I think the further we progress into the story, the more the expectations are wiped away. Like the things that they thought that they had to succeed at in life are then challenged. Mm-hmm. And so by the time that they come out of this, we really don't know what their relationship is like at the end of this movie.
He does say they'll remember this for, we now go to the criminal expert again, and he's all like, what is about to happen as they approach this castle is something that they will remember for a very, very long time. Doesn't describe them as together, doesn't describe it as a happy ending, doesn't describe it any which way except for that it will be momentous to them. And that's good. That's good foreshadowing, because then you don't have like the set Hollywood ending expectation.
Thank you again, Applauder, for time warping with us back to 1975 for our month-long discussion of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. We still have a lot of plot walkthrough to cover, some additional Sean facts, and of course, our shocked and applaudable moments. Looking for even more frank discussion of content of a questionable nature? The After Movie Diner has a new episode discussing Cronenberg's 1996 soliloquy to gratuitous sex and car accidents, Crash. And on Front Face Lock Podcast, you can listen to a drunk watch-along of Anaconda. Check out links to these shows in this release's description. Hey, this is your audio engineer and resident mad scientist, Jen. Now that you've spent some time wandering the audio corridors of our little freak show, why not let us know what's been good, bad, or shareable? By leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser.com, or rating us on Spotify, you not only help lift us up in search results, you also give us inspiration to try new things. You can also leave us feedback or review and rate us directly on ShockedAndApplaud.com. We'll be back in 1 week for part two of this underground 70s cult musical. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.